Hello and welcome to episode 10 of How Positive Are You? This is Christine Maggiore, author of the book, What If Everything You Thought You Knew About AIDS Was Wrong?
And I'm David Crow, president of Rethinking AIDS, an organization of several thousand doctors, scientists, lawyers, writers, social workers, HIV-positive people, and just plain ordinary folks who question the HIV-AIDS paradigm.
In today's episode, we speak with Sarah Breidenbach. Sarah was a highly regarded social worker who specialized in assisting people diagnosed HIV positive or with AIDS. For Sarah, this position was far more than a job. It was an opportunity to help make a real difference in the lives of her clients, and she approached her work with great dedication and conviction. She felt very strongly that by encouraging compliance with AIDS drug treatments and discouraging skepticism about the link between HIV and AIDS, she was offering HIV positives their best possible chances for staying alive. But then, after more than half a decade of professional and personal life that revolved around AIDS from the mainstream perspective, Sarah very reluctantly agreed to watch the documentary film, The Other Side of AIDS. And something remarkable happened as a result. She began to question the entire basis for her staunchly held views, and ultimately to question the direction and meaning of her life's work. Join us today as Sarah recounts her journey into the unknown with intelligence, grace, and unusual honesty.
I'm really looking forward to talking to her.
But before we get into that, David, I believe you have some news items for us.
Well, before that, I have a little bit of feedback.
Got
some positive feedback from some of our listeners. Carol, who's the first winner of one of Dr. Etienne's books, The 10 Lies About AIDS, said, I listen to your show because it is one of the few sources of intelligent news about the wacky world of AIDS. I've been following the insanity for almost 20 years, and every time I see a mainstream article about AIDS spouting the tired old party lines, my heart sinks. Every time a friend or family member unquestioningly believes what they hear about science from, quote, experts, it sinks again. Listening to your podcast reminds me that I'm not the only person on the planet who doesn't swallow all the misinformation we're being fed. Listening to you gives me hope. And I also heard from a gay man recently diagnosed positive who, was going through a lot of confusion. He just discovered that there is another side to AIDS recently. He says, I'm totally healthy and I can't believe that something is slowly eating away inside me and that soon I will be sick, if modern science is correct, that is. I'm being as open-minded as I can and I'm really enjoying listening to and learning everything I can about the dissident views of HIV and AIDS. So he asked us if we could interview or write about people who have consistently tested HIV positive and have been doing so for a long time, at least 10 years, who have not gone on medication and are still very healthy. I'd love to hear from them and see how they are doing and what their stories are. So I think that's actually a really good idea for future podcasts.
Apparently I'm not enough.
Well, no, I think they need to know that you're not just some exception, that there's a lot of people like you. I think it really psychologically helps people to hear from multiple people who've had similar experiences to let them know it's fairly common.
So what do you have in the way of news, David?
Well, from Uganda, a new clinical trial to test whether the use of antiretrovirals drugs could reduce the risk or prevent HIV transmission to a negative partner in a discordant relationship. That would be where one partner is HIV positive and one is HIV negative. They're just starting that because about 50% of HIV positive people are living in discordant relationships in Uganda, which is interesting because if HIV was infectious, they would very soon infect their partner, and 100% of HIV positive people would then be living with HIV positive people.
Right, if it followed the paradigm, all it takes is one time, one contact, you wouldn't have so many serodiscordant people in couples.
So that creates a problem for this trial because according to Padian's 1997 study, at best they could come up with a 1 out of 1,000 risk of transmission of HIV with one incidence of sex. So they're going to need an awful lot of people to see any difference. But worse than that, this is not a trial of taking these drugs versus not taking the drugs. It's a trial of one drug against another. So they will probably, and it's not very clear from the news reports, what they'll probably do is they'll estimate what the risk would be without drugs, and then they'll compare it to the drugs And then without any evidence, they'll say that the drugs are effective. At least that's my guess.
You know, I'm so tired of this stacking the deck in favor of the result you want by comparing drugs to drugs instead of comparing drugs to nothing at all, which was what a drug trial used to be all about. There was always the placebo arm, the unmedicated arm of the trial, where you tested nothing against your proposed treatment. And in a case in which you're trying to prevent transmission of something that the transmission itself is questionable on a scientific level. I mean, where's the virus in these people? But also, scientific studies have shown that positive people do not necessarily give their positive status, whatever that might mean, to a negative partner after many years, even decades, of unprotected relationships. Well, I myself being an example of that. I test positive. My husband does not. We've been together for 12 years.
Right. Yeah, that's quite common. And in fact, in Padian's 1997 study, when in the observational portion of the study, that is, after the study started, they observed couples who were serodiscordant, one positive, one negative, and they didn't find a single case where a negative person became positive during that time, which was about 10 years, actually.
So in order to make this a legitimate trial, you'd have to have three arms. You'd have to have the people taking one drug, the couples, rather, or I guess the negative partner and the couple taking drug A, the negative partner and another group of couples taking drug B, and then a group of couples in which no drugs are taken. And only that way could you see if the drugs made a difference, and also you'd be able to clearly note what are the side effects of taking these drugs and whether there's a risk-benefit ratio to even bothering, since even by the most staunch scientific standards, the risk of transmission is so incredibly low.
Yeah, it's really incredible, but it's not just Uganda. You sent me a little clipping from the Metro newspaper in the UK, which is promoting a very similar concept, what they're calling pre-exposure prophylaxis. So the idea is that before you have sex, you pop a pill, and the pill prevents HIV transmission. And the drugs that they're promoting are called Viriad and Truvada, which are combinations of nucleoside analogs. And if people aren't sure what that is, that's the AZT class of drugs that were first used in 1987. And the problem with those drugs is if you look at the side effects of these drugs, they're absolutely horrendous. Both the drugs being used in this trial have black box warnings. And let me read a few of the side effects that can occur. Renal impairment, that's kidney damage. Decreases in bone mineral density in the spine and hip. Redistribution and accumulation of body fat. The long-term effects of Truvada are unknown. They actually say in the label that I have from 2007 that the ability to prevent HIV transmission has not been proven. Other adverse effects include diarrhea, nausea, fatigue, sinusitis, upper respiratory tract infections, nasopharyngitis, sleepiness, headache, dizziness, depression, insomnia, abnormal dreams, rash, significant laboratory abnormalities, including fasting cholesterol, creatine kinase, serum amylase. Those are important things that can indicate kidney and liver damage. And also, we're not done yet, joint pain, increased anxiety, increased cough, muscle pain, fever, abdominal pain, back pain, hallucination of senses, fever, pneumonia, inflamed nose, rash, and it goes on.
Jeez.
And you're supposed to take these as a perfectly healthy person before having sex to prevent the deadly HIV from being transmitted.
Now, at the same time, they say that AIDS drugs need to be taken consistently in order to prevent mutations of the virus. And these are the same AIDS drugs that they're giving people who are diagnosed positive in order to supposedly prevent transmission of HIV, which rarely occurs, if it even is HIV that's being transmitted. So here people are going to be taking these pills when they have sex occasionally, sometimes on weekends, wouldn't that just completely undo this whole idea that you have to engage in consistent use of these drugs or you cause the virus to mutate or you develop a resistance or all those other things they tell people to discourage them from anything except consistent use of those drugs?
Yeah, it just seems like a horrible idea. And I think the first time that people take these drugs and throw up, they're going to realize that these are not exactly enhancing their sex life. And I just can't see this idea really catching on. But, you know, maybe they'll sell lots of pills that get stocked for free at sexual STD advice clinics and AIDS clinics and things like that. And they might never get used, but at least the drug companies have sold them, and that's all they really care
about.
Yeah,
maybe the drug companies can get governments to buy them and keep them around.
So. Well, yeah, just kind of like the flu vaccines and those flu pills, you know, governments have to stockpile them, and then they're outdated in a year or so, and so then they have to buy a whole bunch, another bunch. So they may never actually use them, but the drug companies are still making lots of money.
Jeez. You know, what's interesting to me, too, the very last line of this article, Dr. Anthony Fauci from the U.S. National Institutes of Health says, quote, "There's a lot of buzz about PrEP, which is the name of this concept that you can do pre-exposure prophylaxis." So he says, "There's a lot of buzz about PrEP. There's some cautious optimism this will work." I don't know if you've noticed this, but Anthony Fauci, his entire job seems to be saying nothing. He just kind of says things that don't really say anything. There's a lot of buzz about PrEP. Wow. You know, from a medical doctor who's the head of our National Institutes of Infectious Diseases, you'd think there might be something more substantive than that, and there's some cautious optimism this will work.
You think
his remarks, too, around the failed vaccines and the failed HIV microbicides were equally as vacant of any real information or critique or just anything that is beyond a non-committal ambassadorial statement that is neither supportive or detractive from the whatever it is he's talking about.
Maybe he's prepping for a job as an MTV news announcer, because that's the kind of thing you'd expect from a television news show that's not trying to be too serious. There's a lot of buzz about something. It doesn't sound like a very scientific, thoughtful comment, does it?
I mean, it sounds like he's talking about a new Britney Spears record. It's just, I don't know. Anyway.
Yes. I have another worrisome news item from the Associated Press. They report that an increasing number of countries worldwide are making spreading HIV a crime, according to a new report from the International Planned Parenthood Federation. 58 countries have laws that criminalize HIV, or, like Canada, use existing laws to prosecute people for transmitting the virus. Another 33 countries are considering similar legislation. Many of the laws in Africa were passed after a meeting in Chad in 2004 sponsored by the U.S. Agency for International Development, that's USAID, the world's biggest funder of AIDS programs, and attended by UN officials. In the U.S., 32 states have laws criminalizing HIV transmission, and experts estimate that thousands of people have been charged across the country with spreading HIV. Since 2001, 16 people in the United Kingdom have been prosecuted for spreading HIV. And in 2005, a woman in Canada was charged with criminal negligence and aggravated assault for passing HIV while pregnant to her baby. She was sentenced to a 6-month conditional sentence followed by 3 years of probation, and probably lost her baby to social services. Now, I'm quoting from the article, so when I say passing HIV to the baby, I'm not putting ironic quotes around that.
Right. And it appalls me to consider people serving life sentences in jail over this notion of transmission when, in fact, in a factual, scientific manner, we do not by any means show that people who are testing positive actually have the virus itself. I'm without words to describe the feeling of despair and shock that we continue as a world population to move forward in this demonization of people who are seropositive. I think that's the best possible description. Their blood tests positive on these nonspecific tests for what we really don't know. But to move this into this area of crimes being charged against people, and I understand too, I believe it is in Norway or Sweden, one of these countries that we tend to consider progressive, that even if you are involved in a consensual relationship with someone and they know that you are positive, you can still be arrested for having sex with them.
I believe that was...
Even though they know and they agree.
I believe that was Switzerland.
Yeah.
But, you know, I think what people don't realize, I mean, it's very easy to condemn somebody who's HIV positive, and they say, well, why don't you just say? But the point is that if your partner, your sexual partner does know, and then the relationship breaks up and creates, at least for some period of time, a feeling of hatred between the two partners, they could very well use that and say, I didn't know. And then if you, you know, if you had told that person in private, which is quite likely how you did it, it's your word against them. So even if they know, that's not really protection for the HIV-positive person. And if you let everybody in the world know that you're HIV-positive, I mean, Christine, you've done that, but for many people, it could result in significant prejudice and even violence against them. So, you know, society is asking a lot from HIV-positive people. And then there's the whole issue of reasonable doubt. I mean, if we're not 100% sure these people are infected with HIV, and we're not 100% sure that it's sexually transmitted, and we're not 100% sure that HIV-positive people necessarily get sick faster than HIV-negative people, where's the concept of reasonable doubt? It's just gone down the drain.
Another thing, too, that concerns me that you bring up with regard to couples who end their relationships, oftentimes there is that animosity that leads people to say things that aren't necessarily true. And I know this very well on a firsthand basis. I work in the area of custody and dissolution of marriages and relationships involving children. And without exception, even in the most amicable breakups, there is a period of time in which unfavorable things are said, and oftentimes these can turn into accusations and allegations that can be straightened out later on. But when it comes to the criminalization of HIV status, I don't know if there's any going back if someone once said something about someone else. I understand in the case of the professional football player in Canada,
Travis Smith.
Yeah, that he is serving, I don't believe it's a life sentence, but a very long sentence.
5.5 years, which puts him in a penitentiary as opposed to a provincial low-security jail.
Right, and the woman that he allegedly didn't give his HIV-positive status to, I read, later changed her mind and said, well, you know, we did have discussions around that, and there was acknowledgement of that, but it's all too late.
Well, yeah, it's once something gets in the hands of the police, it's too late. I mean, even in other circumstances, if a mother accuses a father of sexually abusing their children just to get at him because of a divorce situation, if the police take that serious, take it seriously, it may be too late by the time she says, well, no, I didn't really mean that. And she may not want to say that because of the risk of being charged with perjury, of, you know, making a false statement in front of police. So it is extremely troubling that these HIV-positive people are so vulnerable. They have to keep their status secret because of the prejudice from society, and yet society is saying, well, if you don't tell everybody, then you could go to jail merely for having sex or for having a baby.
Yeah, well, I certainly won't be traveling to Switzerland anytime soon.
Yes, yes. Well, I think it's time to get Sarah on the phone.
I agree. Let's give her a call. Hi, Sarah. Welcome to How Positive Are You?
Hi, Sarah. Thanks for joining us.
Hi, Christine. Hi, David. Thanks so much for having me.
For our listeners, Sarah, I'm just going to briefly explain and introduce you, and then you'll tell us about yourself and your experiences in your own words. You are a social worker who spent essentially your entire career in the area of HIV and AIDS work, with an emphasis on helping Latinos and immigrants from Mexico and also from Africa. This was your life's work in a very absolute sense, I understand from speaking with you. And in Mexico, you went in 2003 to film HIV-positive women there as a way to answer the questions of your clients in the U.S. Who were concerned about healthcare and prejudice and other issues should they return to Mexico. And you were in the city or the area of Puebla. And then you came back to edit the film in 2006. And at that time, your then partner was encouraging you to watch a documentary film called The Other Side of AIDS. And when you finally did very reluctantly watch that film, everything that you thought that your life was about changed. So with that as our introduction, can you tell us about yourself and your work in your own words?
Absolutely. I mean, that is a really accurate summation, very dramatic and true. My life work in HIV started in the year 2000, around and about that time. And I had studied sociology and anthropology in school and was extremely passionate about social work and extremely passionate about doing HIV work. I headed a program for Latinos at Cascade AIDS Project in Portland, Oregon, and later went on to work for Oregon Health Science University in the Multnomah County clinic there. All extremely important, valuable resources to the folks in the HIV/AIDS industry, and was passionate about the work and passionate about serving clients, particularly Latino immigrants, because they had a really specific situation in terms of being HIV-positive, undocumented, living in the United States. When I went down to Mexico, I was furthering that work and really considered myself somewhat of an international expert, if you will, in HIV/AIDS and in terms of being able to communicate all of the science and medicine behind it, felt really articulate, felt really informed and really educated. And when I returned from Mexico to work on editing the film and putting it out there, and I did actually create a 12-minute piece called Machismo Mata that was presented at a big Latino state conference in Oregon, when I was exposed to The Other Side of AIDS and watched that film, my whole life's work crumbled pretty quickly. Initially, questions came up for me that a lot of resistance, but mostly it was sort of this astonishment of, oh my God, if this is true, then what does that mean for the last 7 years of my life? What does that mean about the work I've been doing? What does that mean about the truth that I have been communicating to and educating people about for this long period of time? So, since then, I've been putting the pieces back together and trying to figure out where to go next in terms of recreating a life that I can feel as passionate about as I did before, unveiling all of the new theories in my experience around HIV/AIDS and the paradigm shift and finding my place in terms of my relationship to my community and my friends who I've attempted to communicate these changes to, but many of whom are really resistant and not really open to talking about it. They'll listen, I guess, to my verse, and then they kind of dismiss it. That's been the general experience. So, yeah, in my words, that's sort of my experience around my relationship to HIV/AIDS and that whole paradigm and shift for me.
Were there aspects of your former experience as a social worker that you looked on with very different eyes after you'd been exposed to Robin's film?
There were many, some of which were I started to think about how many people I had informed about the disease progression itself. I had like a whole drawing that I would do every single time I had new patients who were newly diagnosed or folks who had very little education, ability to read or write. I served, on my caseload, I would have like hundreds of clients, or at least over 100, many of whom, you know, were Spanish-speaking and would come in with family members or alone and needing to know, like, well, what does this mean? What is this? And so I would inform them of, okay, you've been infected with this HIV virus. This virus then goes into your T cells, and it replicates within a T cell until it kills that T cell, and then it goes on to find another T cell. And so the messenger T cell is unable to, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And I had a whole spiel, and I went back and thought, oh, my God, where did I learn that? Where did I get that information from? Because it's not accurate. And yet I was supported by the medical professionals that I was working with as well as the other social workers who would hear me give that spiel in full support. But it's not, since then I've researched extensively to, like, look at, okay, where did I get this information from? And I have no idea. It was sort of passed down to me from other social workers, or I overheard it, you know, talking with doctors. So it really made me begin to question all truths that I carry and speak about to people in general. When I'm educating people or thinking that I'm coming from an informed position, it made me really begin to question where I get any of my information before calling it true or before passing that on to other people. The other aspects of my work that I really started to look at were how are people dying? Because I watched people who were on their deathbeds come back to life, and I believed that was because of AIDS meds. I watched other people die from AIDS meds. And most of the time, that felt okay. I mean, it never felt great, but it felt all of the medical professionals that I worked with, we all knew, and the social workers, we all knew that AIDS drugs were toxic. Nobody ever denied that. We all knew, oh, God, these meds are awful. They're toxic, but they're getting better. They're developing new ones all the time. And they always felt like a better alternative than death, which was what we thought we were doing, I thought. And I believe that all the amazing people that I worked with thought we were saving lives. And it's an incredibly heroic position to be in when you think that you're saving lives. And so I began to question all of that and looking at how were people dying. They were, you know, of liver toxicity. There was a lot of liver failure, a lot of kidney failure and things like that. And wanting to go back and say, okay, like, were these people really dying of AIDS? Or were they just dying of over medication? So those are some of the aspects. There are many in which I retrospectively have had to sort of confront and question and look at.
You said that you were reluctant to consider this other viewpoint and watch the film that your then partner was urging you to watch, and that now when you talk to your former colleagues, they express the same kind of resistance. What do you think forms that resistance? I mean, I know you can speak to yourself personally what your resistance was about. And then also if you could speculate or imagine what the resistance on the part of your colleagues is.
Yeah. It's a multifaceted question. I mean, there are, for myself, and I think this is probably true for the folks doing the same work, and I have a lot of patience and respect for where they're coming from because I was in the same position when I was being presented with the ideas. And I think that there's several reasons. One, you don't really want to change your reality, your existence, your purpose. I mean, having to question your entire life purpose is a really difficult thing to do. And for me, because my it was my life's work, having to question whether that whole theory or paradigm was true meant questioning who I was and what I did, and my reality, and my identity. So if you question all those things, it means having to let them all go. It means having to grieve the death of them if you no longer believe in them. It means having to change your entire path. And I think that requires a lot of work and requires a lot of, fearless strength. And it's a hard thing to do. It's a hard thing to face. So I think that's one reason that people resist. I think, secondly, you don't want to face that you are possibly helping to do the opposite of what you thought you were doing. In other words, I thought that I was saving lives, and I know that everyone I was working with thought the same thing. And if you start to look at the fact that you might be doing the opposite by, for example, my role oftentimes as a social worker was to get people access to health insurance and ultimately get them access to heart treatments. So I'm getting folks access to AIDS drugs as quickly as possible, and I'm encouraging people to take these meds to tolerate them despite side effects, et cetera, getting them support treatments like acupuncture to deal with the side effects, et cetera. That was pretty much the main purpose. I mean, I helped people with a lot of other care needs, and I can talk more about that if you're interested. But when you realize that, oh, my God, what if I was helping people to die more quickly instead of to live longer? I mean, the mind, it grapples with that, and it's a really challenging position to be in. So I think that's another reason that you would resist looking into this further. And then lastly, you don't want to lose your friends and community. I know that for myself, my heart was broken when thinking about that I may not have, what I thought I was doing wasn't what I was really doing, but my heart was even more broken when I began to realize that my position within my community was going to change, that I was not going to be the same, you know, I was considered like one of the best social workers on the team. I could get through to the really hard-to-reach populations, the hard-to-reach people. People really listened to me. And that feeds your ego, but it also just feeds your sense of purpose, and you have these friends and people in your community who aren't going to see you in the same light, or you're not going to have the same common ground on which to bond around. There's a really tight-knit love that happens within that community because you're all united behind the same purpose.
It's kind of like what happens to people in a war setting where you're on the front lines together and you're facing a lot of difficult, traumatic, highly emotional situations together, that there's this bonding that happens that I would imagine runs very deep. And to walk away from that, to leave that, must be extraordinarily difficult and like leaving a part of your soul behind.
Absolutely. I mean, that's exactly what I experienced. I mean, what I have sometimes called it is, it felt like a death of self, because it does run that deep. You are bonded. It's, you know, trauma bonding is a really powerful thing. And you, in the setting that I was in, it was the county clinic, and it was like, you know, we all bonded around the fact that we were in the trenches, that we were dealing with folks who nobody else wanted to deal with. And the stories that we saw happen, unfold before us each day, you know, even if it wasn't around, you know, the subject of AIDS, or it was around homelessness and drug addiction and mental health stuff, we bonded. We were such a tight-knit family, and leaving that behind or saying I can't do that anymore was one of the hardest things I've ever had to do, because it was truly something I was so proud of.
How would you describe, you mentioned your community, what do you mean by that?
What I mean by that is the community of folks doing HIV AIDS work I can only speak for Portland, Oregon, but I think it's true around the country. There are these different agencies. They're all funded by Ryan White money. A lot of them are funded by state money, federal money, and they're all connected. We all know who each other is. There's different agencies. Some are connected to, you know, the clinic settings. Others are just social-based in terms of, like, housing, social networking or social mental health supports, et cetera. But there's this network of folks doing specifically HIV/AIDS work, and we all know who each other is, and we all become, you know, part of a family that we all work together on teams to help support this client base. So in a work setting, it becomes your community, but it becomes more than that because it's such a specialized field. And because you go through this trauma together, there's sort of this, like, unique bond, and it's made up of, like, a lot of, you know, queer folks are in that community, a lot of really open-minded, liberal folks. It's just sort of like then you take that into your social life. You then have this group of people that you consider your family both in the workplace and outside the workplace because we all understand each other. We all understand the work that we go through. It's like being a part of a special club.
Now that you're on the outside, what is that like for you? And how do people see you from the inside out?
Yeah, it's something that I still honestly have to explore because I sort of ran away when I was dealing with the emotions of all of this and the pain of sort of the loss that I was facing. I didn't really know what to do with myself. I didn't know where to insert my skills or insert my person back into the world of social work or the workforce in general. In fact, I left the country for a while and have been sort of processing all of this from afar because I felt that I needed some distance in order to kind of rebuild myself and or understand myself, because what became really clear was that the sort of collective conscious of that community or the collective truth wasn't mine anymore. So I had to go and figure out what mine was and sort of recreate who I was. And so initially, I can tell you that when I went to different people within that community, I know I keep using this word, but, you know, specifically, like, I worked with really closely with some doctors, and would go to some of those folks, you know, over dinner and say, like, hey, these ideas have all changed for me. I've watched this film. I got Christine's book. I'm reading these different ideas, and I have questions for you. And I would go into specifics, like, can we talk about, you know, the HIV antibody test? Can we talk about viral loads and T cells? This is my understanding. What's your understanding? And the reactions were sort of like a head shaking, oh, no, you haven't gone there. Oh, no, Sarah, you're not one of them. And those are some of the initial reactions that people would give me. And it was really heartbreaking because I'm like, I'm not one of them. What are you referring to? And
the way it's often described, it's almost like invasion of the body snatchers, where some evil entity takes over your brain and you're suddenly a, quote, denialist. And that's a really offensive, simplistic and cruel dismissal of the very serious, heartfelt questions that you came up against in having to confront one paradigm with the other. Your view, once you've had information that conflicted with that, how do you feel about being kind of dismissed as, oh no, you've become one of them?
Yeah, I mean, the whole denialist or dissident labels really bothered me. In fact, so much so that at times I would, I sort of went into a state for a month or two where I was, like, declaring unresolved status. I don't know. I have questions, but I'm not sure what the answers are. I'm not sure how I feel about this. And so I carried that for a little while, just sort of, it made me feel a little more neutral to say, well, I don't know, I've just been more innocently, like, I've been exposed to these ideas, and I have questions, and I'm not saying that I know one way or the other, and so I sort of held that middle ground for a little bit, and then, you know, I would read more things or watch the film again at times and just say, like, oh, I don't have questions about this, I'm just scared. I'm scared of losing who I am, who I was. I'm scared of losing my friends and community. I'm scared of being labeled as an outsider or someone who is a danger to people's health, because people, there is this other, you know, when they talk about the president of South Africa, Mbeki, or other folks who are dissidents, it's like these ideas are not only controversial, they're dangerous. If you tell people that AIDS drugs are harmful, then you're telling them not to take them, then you're telling them to die. And so being in that camp, or, you know, having folks attempt to label me as such was so terrifying that at times I'd say, like, okay, never mind, I'm unresolved. I don't really know, I'm just asking questions, which just really wasn't true. But that's how uncomfortable it would feel. And it's part of why I just left town. Like, honestly, I was like, this community is so small, so tight, I need to get away, because I didn't want to face it. So it's really uncomfortable to be on the other side, yet it felt also like the red flag, having people react that strongly, that emotionally, that sort of black and white, complete, you know, there's one side or another side, was the very thing that kept me going and kept me asking questions, because I thought, like, if you're having this extreme of a reaction, there's something wrong here.
It seems to me it's a little bit like a religion that has become a community, like the Seventh-day Adventists, for example. If people violate some precept of that religion, such as, I guess it's Jehovah's Witnesses that don't allow blood transfusions, but if there's ever a dispute over that, the person who rejects that precept of the church will be shunned by people who are not just sharing a religion, but also family and friends. And that can be an incredibly devastating event when it occurs. It seems like there's a parallel.
Yeah, there is a parallel, and yet I'm cautious to label, you know, to do the same thing that was done to me. Like, I don't want to, in turn, label folks doing HIV/AIDS work from this old paradigm, which is how I refer to it, the old paradigm, it's the other paradigm, whatever. I don't want to label them as, like, culty, scary folks either, because I feel like that's exactly what was done to me, and so I'm really cautious about doing that. And there are, you know, I will say that there are some folks that I worked with who had patients that were seeking alternative treatments and who were saying, you know, I'm not going to take these AIDS drugs, I'm not going to do that. And they were in support of that. You know, they were definitely in support of patients doing what they felt were best. But ultimately, behind the scenes, you know, after they walked away from that medical appointment, they'd say, yeah, but eventually they're going to have to come back to AIDS drugs if they want to live. So they would support that, but the true, like, conditioned thinking was still like, well, if they want to live at all, they're gonna end up coming back to us, or they're gonna die.
What do you think the views of a professional person such as yourself, the other social workers, the doctors, and people you worked with, your ideas about what would happen to people? You said you'd draw a picture and you'd show the T cells being attacked. Do you look back and wonder what your influence might be, your collective influence on people's outcomes? Because we know to a certain extent that your expectations become your outcome. I mean, would you have some thoughts on that?
Yeah, I mean, I think that that's one of the hardest areas to sort of resolve within me in terms of some of the remorse around how did I affect people's lives? How did I affect, I mean, we affect each other's lives all of the time, but I often had people who were newly diagnosed who were just distraught. Suicidal ideation was something I dealt with on a weekly basis with my client base. I mean, there were a lot of people who were depressed, anxious, and suicidal. And my role was to obviously insert hope where I could, but often the vehicle through which I inserted that hope was, we have these meds. We have these meds that you can take that are getting better all the time, and you're going to be okay, which is hard for me to swallow now because I don't... The stuff that I was dishing out in order to offer up hope for folks who were in desperate situations wasn't necessarily their best option. And there, I did at times have a couple of people who came in and were, oh, I want to talk to you about the fact that this may not exist, and, you know, this isn't true, this is a conspiracy. And I just had an aversion, as many people do, to the word conspiracy. It's like, oh, conspiracy theorists, it's like this, you know, this big camp of folks who are nuts. And so I would have, you know, just my immediate reaction was, okay, like, I'll listen, I'll hear you out. But, you know, ultimately, do you want to live or do you want to die? And I didn't never said that directly, but and that's where my thoughts came from. And I mean, I watched and supported, you know, the little children getting meds pumped into them through their mouths after being born. You know, this, like, I don't even remember which med it was, but I remember it being blue and in the syringe that we were trying to put into their mouths, and watching the fear in this little kid's eyes and saying, like, okay, but this is going to save this kid's life. And yeah, I mean, when you're told you have a fatal disease, and then you have medical professionals and social workers enforcing those ideas and yet trying to tell you that there's hope, it's like, you know, how much did I affect the well-being of individuals? It's really hard stuff to find peace with for me.
Within the communities that you were working with, did you see any patterns in the people who were HIV positive versus their families and friends who weren't? Like, was there a higher rate of drug abuse or other characteristics?
I rarely worked with whole families, and part of this work was often that people tended to isolate and didn't have strong relationships with families. When they did, it was like a rare and beautiful thing, and typically it really varied because I, like I said, I was working in a setting that was sort of, we did not turn anyone away. So if people didn't have insurance, et cetera. So what we ended up seeing were people who had many other conditions, and HIV was like something that we didn't even really get to. It was like, are you taking meds? Great. Okay. Let's talk about the fact that you have no house. Let's talk about the fact that you're not taking your mental health meds. Let's talk about the fact that you are addicted to drugs. And so those were things that had it pre-existed them ever testing positive for HIV and had been lifelong struggles. So in those cases, it seemed sort of almost unrelated to the HIV. And that was something that at times had persisted through the family. Their family members were also, you know, their parents of parents had also been dealing with some of those same issues throughout their lives, you know. So I didn't necessarily, the one thing that definitely was different was suicide ideation. That was something that, you know, definitely I saw more of with folks who were HIV positive than you would see with family members, for example. I don't know if that answers your question.
Yeah,
but,
yeah.
Okay.
I have a question for you, and I don't know if this is something that you could answer, but here you are really deep into this work on an emotional level, on a social level, on a fiscal level. I mean, this is what paid the rent. This is how you made your living. This is how you identified yourself. Yet, although it was reluctant, you did have the whatever it takes to sit down and watch this film. And you had what I can only imagine would be something like an open mind, an open heart, to let it in such a way that you considered it deeply and thoughtfully and allowed it to find its place in your way of thinking about everything that was your life. To me, that is rare. It's unusual. I mean, most people will end at the reluctance and the resistance and return to the thing that they're doing that rewards them socially, fiscally, and you know, it rewards their sense of social consciousness, I guess you could say, too. Why you? Why not them? I mean, do you ever ask yourself that? Do you ever wonder what's the difference between you and them?
Yeah. Yeah, I have asked myself that. Like, why in the hell? Like, there were times, Christine, I think you remember, I wrote you and Robin after seeing the film and was like, oh, man, you guys have totally messed up my life. I've got questions for you.
I remember apologizing because I do get these calls and emails and letters from people sometimes where they say, you have turned my life upside down. I'm just like, oh, God. that it's weird because then I feel a tremendous sense of responsibility and also allegiance because to a lesser extent, I've been in your position. I was the mainstream AIDS educator, and I certainly didn't have that going on in my world defining me for as long as you did, much, much less time. But I was a hero of sorts, and I was very popular, and I felt very passionate. And I, too, experienced the, uh-oh, there's this other view, and it's looking like it makes a lot of sense, more sense than what I've been doing. And I tried asking people and talking with people, and except for one or two adventurous souls, I was excommunicated, so to speak. But I've sat up many a times and wondered, why me and not them? What is it about me that made me susceptible or available to considering other viewpoints that were, in the words of Al Gore, really a terribly inconvenient truth?
Yeah, incredibly inconvenient. I mean, I had this film project that I was working on. I had other ideas in the works, and suddenly funding for what I wanted to do disappeared. I was like, oh my God, where am I going to go? I can't, there's no support to do this work if you're not doing it from the stance of, we have this virus that we can test for. It causes this disease called AIDS, and you know, this boom, boom, boom formula. If you don't believe in the formula, then you're not going to get funding, you're not going to get support, you're not going to be able to do your work anymore. And I had moments of just, like, breaking down in tears, crying, like, even screaming, like, what am I going to do now? Like, I just want to go back. I want to go back. I want to go back to believing this paradigm. My life made so much sense, and it was easy to follow, and it was easy, and now here I am in this completely uncharted territory. I have no idea where to begin, and do I just walk away from it all and completely start a whole new career path? And that's tempting at times because, it's been a process. And I remember I was sitting with you and Robin. Robin says, "So what are you doing?" I'm like, "I did HIV work. Don't you remember? You guys totally screwed up my life by putting this information out there, and now I don't know what I do. If you ask me what I do, I don't know. I don't know how to answer that question anymore." And when I've asked, like, why me, I think that I've always been, I'm a Sagittarius, you know. Sagittarians are like seekers of truth. They're travelers, they're seekers of truth, and et cetera, et cetera. But I also think that there was already cracks developing within the formula for me around public health in general, because I saw what was happening. I had already had many issues with the system that was in place that was supposed to be helping people get well, and I was watching people be very unwell. I was watching people become addicted and attached to their diagnoses, their list of diagnoses. I mean, people would rattle off all of their, you know, diagnoses of mental health and or other health, like physical complications. I mean, people loved their diagnoses list. And it was almost like if they came in and found out that everything was fine, they weren't comfortable with that anymore. They're like, well, no, there's got to be something wrong. You know, I have AIDS. I'm HIV positive. There's always going to be something happening with my health. And it made me so sad because many times I had folks in my office that I was saying, you're fine. You're healthy. You're okay. And they found that really unsettling. And that started to really disturb me and really started to make me question what we were doing, what we were creating, when people weren't comfortable being totally healthy or had a hard time believing that they were.
What you're bringing up right now is something that I question too, the concept of support groups that support negative predictions and outcomes. And I remember feeling a lot like you, where I'm sitting in a group that's called a support group, and what are we supporting when people seem pleased and proud and like I don't even know they've achieved something when they can announce they have a new symptom they've presented with, or you know, like I had my drop in T cells. It was really weird. It started to be like, well, there you go, and that's what it's all about. And now, you know, when is it going to be your turn? And we just were taught to expect. It almost felt like encourage bad things, you know, adverse events, a gradual deterioration of everything in our lives. And I thought, at that time, I had become a spokesperson for support groups for women, for women at risk, and also for general support groups for LA Shanti Foundation. And they would want me out at public events to talk about the benefits of support groups. And I would just, it got to the point where I showed up at one event and I said, I can't do it. I can't do it, because really, I think it's better for my soul, for my mind, and for my health to be at home watching The Simpsons.
Mm-hmm.
It just felt a heck of a lot more healing.
Yeah, absolutely. No, I mean, there is this, it not only has affected the way I see the work I used to do, but my entire life lens, because I've started to look around and realize that, like, there's a lot of people talking about the dramas of life, and I started even calling some of the people that I come across as life endurers. You know, we're here to endure life, and if there's no gossip or something negative or tragic happening in an individual's life, they'll talk about what's happening in other people's lives. And, oh, isn't that awful? Aunt Betty has this horrible new case of cancer, or so-and-so his kid has been kicked. I mean, people are talking about the dramas and tragedies with such passion that it's just, you know, reinforcing and creating this ball of negative energy that is not just specific to the public health industry. It's become part of the fabric of our society.
And the more exotic and rare and terminal it seems sometimes, the better. But more positively, have you landed on your feet? Have you found a new career or a new purpose in life out of all this?
Yeah. So here we are talking about all these negative drama events.
Yeah, I'm trying to stop the two of you from
spiraling downwards.
Exactly. Yeah, no, I have been living in Taiwan, and it has actually been an amazing opportunity to really tap into my own creative force and have been making art again, and am actually in the works of doing pre-production work around a follow-up or a new film that is based from what I had started in Mexico back in 2003 when I did this short piece called Machismo Mata. I'm now working with a partner in trying to form a new synopsis, a new piece, to go back to Mexico and really start talking about health and healing from a different perspective. And this whole paradigm shift for me has created an abundance of positive outlooks in terms of what I can do and what I can create in this world. And now the women that I interviewed in the first film were incredibly sad. There were tons of tears, lots of desperately sad stories and life situations. And so I now feel that my calling or my life's purpose is to continue working within health and healing, but doing so from a really alternative perspective. It's changed my own personal path. I used to be very attached to my own story around my own mental health, and by questioning health and science and saying, you know, there's not just one path, there's not one truth, you can ask all these questions, and that's the whole juice behind science, that's what keeps it going, I've been able to ask those questions within my own life and write new stories. And so in the writing of a new story for my own self, I feel like I'm able to now consider writing new stories that can then be shared in the public eye for, you know, health and healing. So the next film will be going back to Mexico, meeting with those women and asking the questions of their emotional attachment to their story, to their sadness, how much is that affecting their health? And there's a doctor there in Mexico doing very alternative approaches to just changing people's diet, taking them off AIDS drugs, changing their diet, and having incredible success. So it's my hope that I'll be able to continue doing documentary film work and doing so from these other perspectives and really offering greater hope and positive possibilities for people and true wellness instead of, you know, what we were talking about previously.
Well, that is really positive. I'm afraid I have to leave the call now, which is not positive, but the two of you can continue. I'll leave the line up if you'd like.
Well, I think that we've pretty much talked this out. How do you feel, Sarah? Is there anything that you would like to add to the discussion before we sign off, so to speak? Anything you want to say to...
Yeah.
You know, if you had a worldwide forum for a few minutes or maybe the attention of your coworkers, what would it be that you would say?
Yeah, I think that I would say that I don't know any other people, really, who have changed in terms of being on one side of dedicating their lives to doing HIV/AIDS work to coming to the other side of it and saying, wait a minute, we don't really know what this is, and let's talk about what's really causing immune deficiency within people in our world on a global scale right now. And I think that I would say to people who are in a place of fear that it's okay. It's okay to be afraid of realizing this is one of the biggest global myths that we've seen, and it's okay to be afraid of what that means for yourself, your identity, your life's work, and that breaking through that fear or sitting with that fear and moving through to the other side is one of the most beautiful experiences I've ever been through. And so I just would want to say that I'm here to support people through that process, and I could use continued support as well. And so I think that the more people who are open to just even having questions be present, that poke holes in the science that is currently being practiced, that, you know, I welcome those individuals, those groups, whoever it may be, so that we can support each other through this process and really provide a health and alternative healing to each other and to the people who are in the throes of this science currently on treatments, etc.
I just, as every time I talk to you, just struck by your incredible intelligence, your amazing open-mindedness, open-heartedness, your ability to articulate what you've been through. And just the courage and integrity that it takes to allow your life to be shaken up to the degree that yours has is just a beautiful thing. And I just feel very honored to know you, and very honored that you would take the time to speak with us today.
Yeah, and I feel very honored to meet you. It's an incredible story, and I really look forward to hearing some updates about your documentary and other things. I mean, I think you've given us a very positive. You've found something very positive out of something that started with a lot of negativity. So, I'm very pleased to talk to you.
Oh, I really want to thank you both also for giving me the opportunity to. This is the first time that I've really spoken publicly about all of these issues, and to tell you the truth, I was quite nervous before receiving your call and knowing, oh my God, I'm really going to put it out there now. I mean, this is it. I've been holding all of this sort of within and putting it here and there, but not really, you know, in terms of blogging and writing about it, but not really publicly speaking about it. And so I feel really fortunate to have had this opportunity to put my voice out there, to put my story out there, and to talk about everything that I've been through and everything that I hope to accomplish in the future. So thank you both so much. And Christine, every time I talk to you, I feel the same way. I mean, that's part of what has helped my process. I remember the first time I talked to you on the phone, I thought, oh, this woman's not crazy. She's really intelligent and really easy to talk with. And so it has helped my process in terms of being able to take in this information. And there's, you know, there's so much technical science behind this that's so easy to lose people in when talking about. People say, well, what do you mean HIV doesn't cause AIDS? What does it mean? And it's so nice to be able to say, okay, well, go check out this website. Please read this book, because the science is, you know, it's tedious and technical, and a lot of people don't have the capacity to, like, you know, pick that apart and understand it. So it's been great to have those resources available.
And I'm sure that your sharing of this will also touch many, many people's lives and give them perhaps the same courage and sense that it's okay to explore the other side of what you think you know.
Yeah. And I talk about it being a painful process, but that's actually, it's been so full of really rich and wonderful realizations and changes. I mean, I feel better than I've ever felt in my life. And yeah, I mean, that says a lot to me about these changes being nothing but good, really. It opens up a whole world when you don't have to hold so tightly to something informing your truth and life.
Well, thank you. And I really do hope that we can perhaps have you on the show again after your documentary is done, or at some other time like that.
Yeah, I would love to continue to stay in touch and to talk about the film as it develops. That would be great. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Well, that was a remarkable conversation with Sarah. I'm really moved by her experiences and just her honesty.
Yes, and the challenges that she's had to face, and how she's put her moral beliefs and feelings above what would have been very easy to go back into the fold where life was very comfortable.
Yeah, it's certainly an inconvenience to have to rethink what you've dedicated your life and life's work to.
Yes.
Say the least.
Yeah, it takes a lot of moral courage, so I'm very pleased that she was willing to share that with us.
Also, too, for people who are interested perhaps in communicating with Sarah or finding out about the progress of her film, you can go to episode 10 on our new How Positive Are You website and find information there in the blog pertaining to this particular episode about Sarah and how to reach her.
Yeah, that's howpositivearyou.com. And you can actually register. That gives you the ability to participate in our blog, and you can leave comments on any episode and enter into a bit of a discussion with other listeners. we expect that as time goes on, a lot of people will sign up, and there'll be some vigorous discussion going on, and it'll probably help us generate ideas for new episodes, too.
So I hope you all will join us for episode 11 of How Positive Are You? Thank you for listening today.
Yes, thanks, everybody, and join us again next time.
Bye-bye.
Bye.